they were taken. He couldn't make head or tail of it, but it was wonderful, wonderful all the same. They gave him a reason for hating Poppet, and they made his hatred more real. They even made Poppet himself more real. One day, when he came in from playing, the door of the inner room was open, and he saw them lying together on the bed, asleep, white Linda and Poppet almost black beside her, with one arm under her shoulders and the other dark hand on her breast, and one of the plaits of his long hair lying across her throat like a black snake trying to strangle her. Poppet's gourd and a cup were standing on the floor near the bed. Linda was snoring. His heart seemed to have disappeared and left a hole. He was empty, empty and cold and rather sick and giddy. He leaned against the wall to steady himself, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, like drums, like the men singing for the corn, like magic, the words repeated and repeated themselves in his head. From being cold, he was suddenly hot. His cheeks burnt with the rush of blood. The room swam and darkened before his eyes. He ground his teeth. "I'll kill him, I'll kill him, I'll kill him," he kept saying. And suddenly there were more words. "When he is drunk asleep, or in his rage, or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed." The magic was on his side. The magic explained and gave orders. He stepped back into the outer room. "When he is drunk asleep." The knife for the meat was lying on the floor near the fireplace. He picked it up and tiptoed to the door again. "When he is drunk asleep. Drunk asleep." He ran across the room and stabbed. Oh, the blood! Stabbed again. As Poppet heaved out of his sleep, lifted his hand to stab once more, but found his wrist caught, held, and twisted. He couldn't move. He was trapped. And there were Poppet's small black eyes very close, staring into his own. He looked away. There were two cuts on Poppet's left shoulder. "Oh, look at the blood!" Linda was crying. "Look at the blood!" She had never been able to bear the sight of blood. Poppet lifted his other hand to strike him, he thought. He stiffened to receive the blow, but the hand only took him under the chin and turned his face, so that he had to look again into Poppet's eyes. For a long time, for hours and hours. And suddenly he couldn't help it. He began to cry. Poppet burst out laughing. "Go," he said in the other Indian words. "Go, my brave Ahayuta!" He ran out into the other room to hide his tears. "You are 15, said old Mitsima, in the Indian words. "Now I may teach you to work the clay." Squatting by the river, they worked together. "First of all," said Mitsima, taking a lump of the wetted clay between his hands, "we make a little moon." The old man squeezed the lump into a disc, then bent up the edges. The moon became a shallow cup. Slowly and unskillfully, he imitated the old man's delicate gestures. "A moon, a cup, and now a snake." Mitsima rolled out another piece of clay into a long, flexible cylinder, hooped it into a circle, and pressed it onto the rim of the cup. "Then another snake, and another, and another." Round by round, Mitsima built up the sides of the pot. It was narrow, it bulged, it narrowed again towards the neck. Mitsima squeezed and patted, stroked and scraped. And there at last it stood, in shape the familiar water-pot of Malpais, but creamy white instead of black, and still soft to the touch. The crooked parody of Mitsima's, his own, stood beside it. Looking at the two pots, he had to laugh. "But the next one will be better," he said, and began to moisten another piece of clay. To fashion, to give form, to feel his fingers gaining in skill and power, this gave him an extraordinary pleasure. ABC, vitamin D, he sang to himself as he worked. The fat's in the liver, the cod's in the sea. And Mitsima also sang a song about killing a bear. They worked all day, and all day he was filled with an intense, absorbing happiness.
Next winter, said old Mitsima, I will teach you to make the bow.
He stood for a long time outside the house, and at last the ceremonies within were finished. The door opened. They came out. Kotlu came first, his right hand outstretched and tightly closed, as though over some precious jewel. Her clenched hand similarly outstretched, Kiakime followed. They walked in silence, and in silence behind them came the brothers and sisters and cousins and all the troop of old people. They walked out of the pueblo across the mesa. At the edge of the cliff they halted, facing the early morning sun. Kotlu opened his hand. A pinch of cornmeal lay white on the palm. He breathed on it, murmured a few words, then threw it, a handful of white dust, towards the sun. Kiakime did the same. Then Kiakime's father stepped forward, and holding up a feathered prayer stick, made a long prayer, then threw the stick after the cornmeal.
It is finished,
said old Mitsima in a loud voice.
They are married.
Well, said Linda as they turned away, all I can say is it does seem a lot of fuss to make about so little. In civilized countries, when a boy wants to have a girl, he just... But where are you going, John?
He paid no attention to her calling, but ran on, away, away, anywhere to be by himself. It is finished. Old Mitsima's words repeated themselves in his mind. Finished. Finished. In silence, and from a long way off, but violently, desperately, hopelessly, he had loved Kiakime. And now it was finished. He was 16. At the full moon, in the Antelope Kiva, secrets would be told. Secrets would be done and born. They would go down, boys, into the kiva, and come out again, men. The boys were all afraid, and at the same time impatient. And at last it was the day. The sun went down, the moon rose. He went with the others. Men were standing, dark at the entrance to the kiva. The ladder went down into the red-lighted depths. Already the leading boys had begun to climb down. Suddenly one of the men stepped forward, caught him by the arm, and pulled him out of the ranks. He broke free and dodged back into his place among the others. This time the man struck him, pulled his hair.
"Not for you, white hair! Not for the son of the she-dog!" said one of the other men.
The boys laughed.
"Ha, ha, ha, go!"
And as he still hovered on the fringes of the group,
"Go!"
the men shouted again. One of them bent down, took a stone, threw it. "Go! Go! Go!" There was a shower of stones. Bleeding, he ran away into the darkness. From the red-lit kiva came the noise of singing. The last of the boys had climbed down the ladder. He was all alone. All alone, outside the pueblo, on the bare plain of the mesa. The rock was like bleached bones in the moonlight. Down in the valley, the coyotes were howling at the moon. The bruises hurt him. The cuts were still bleeding. But it was not for pain that he sobbed. It was because he was all alone. Because he had been driven out, alone, into this skeleton world of rocks and moonlight. At the edge of the precipice, he sat down. The moon was behind him. He looked down into the black shadow of the mesa, into the black shadow of death. He had only to take one step, one little jump. He held out his right hand in the moonlight. From the cut on his wrist, the blood was still oozing. Every few seconds, a drop fell, dark, almost colourless in the dead light. Drop, drop, drop. Tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. He had discovered time, and death, and God. Alone. Always alone, the young man was saying. The words awoke a plaintive echo in Bernard's mind. Alone. Alone. So am I, he said in a gush of confidingness. Terribly alone. Are you? John looked surprised. I thought that in the other place... I mean, Linda always said that nobody was ever alone there. Bernard blushed uncomfortably. You see, he said, mumbling and with averted eyes, I'm rather different from most people, I suppose. If one happens to be decanted different... Yes, that's just it, the young man nodded. If one's different, one's bound to be lonely. They're beastly to one. Do you know, they shut me out of absolutely everything. When the other boys were sent out to spend the night on the mountains, you know, when you have to dream which your sacred animal is, they wouldn't let me go with the others. They wouldn't tell me any of the secrets. I did it by myself, though, he added. Didn't eat anything for 5 days, and then went out one night alone into those mountains there. He pointed. Patronizingly, Bernard smiled. And did you dream of anything? He asked. The other nodded. But I mustn't tell you what. He was silent for a little. Then, in a low voice, Once, he went on, I did something that none of the others did. I stood against a rock in the middle of the day, in summer, with my arms out, like Jesus on the cross. What on earth for? I wanted to know what it was like being crucified, hanging there in the sun. But why? Why? Well, he hesitated, because I felt I ought to. If Jesus could stand it. And then if one has done something wrong... Besides, I was unhappy. That was another reason. Seems a funny way of curing your unhappiness, said Bernard. But on second thoughts, he decided that there was, after all, some sense in it. Better than taking soma. I fainted after a time, said the young man. Fell down on my face. Do you see the mark where I cut myself? He lifted the thick yellow hair from his forehead. The scar showed pale and puckered on his right temple. Bernard looked, and then, quickly, with a little shudder, averted his eyes. His conditioning had made him not so much pitiful as profoundly squeamish. The mere suggestion of illness or wounds was to him not only horrifying, but even repulsive and rather disgusting, like dirt or deformity or old age. Hastily, he changed the subject. "I wonder if you'd like to come back to London with us," he asked, making the first move in a campaign whose strategy he had been secretly elaborating ever since, in the little house, he had realized who the father of this young savage must be. Would you like that? The young man's face lit up. Do you really mean it? Of course, if I can get permission, that is. Linda, too? He hesitated doubtfully. That revolting creature? No, it was impossible. Unless... It suddenly occurred to Bernard that her very revoltingness might prove an enormous asset. But of course, he cried, making up for his first hesitations with an excess of noisy cordiality. The young man drew a deep breath. To think it should be coming true, what I've dreamt of all my life. Do you remember what Miranda said? Who's Miranda? But the young man had evidently not heard the question. Oh, wonder, he was saying. In his eyes shone, his face was brightly flushed. How many goodly creatures are there here? How beauteous mankind is! The flush suddenly deepened. He was thinking of Lenina, of an angel in bottle-green viscous, lustrous with youth and skin-food, plump, benevolently smiling. His voice faltered. "Oh, brave new world," he began, then suddenly interrupted himself. The blood had left his cheeks. He was as pale as paper.
"Are you married to her?" he asked.
"Am I what?"
"Married, you know, forever. They say forever in the Indian words. It can't be broken."
"Lord, no!" Bernard couldn't help laughing. John also laughed, but for another reason. Laughed for pure joy.
"Oh, brave new world," he repeated. "Oh, brave new world that has such people in it. Let's start at once."
"You have a most peculiar way of talking sometimes," said Bernard, staring at the young man in perplexed astonishment.
"And anyhow, hadn't you better wait until you actually see the new world?"
Chapter 9. Lenina felt herself entitled, after this day of queerness and horror, to a complete and absolute holiday. As soon as they got back to the rest house, she swallowed 6 half-gram tablets of soma, lay down on her bed, and within 10 minutes had embarked for lunar eternity. It would be 18 hours at the least before she was in time again. Bernard, meanwhile, lay pensive and wide-eyed in the dark. It was long after midnight before he fell asleep. Long after midnight. But his insomnia had not been fruitless. He had a plan. Punctually on the following morning, at 10 o'clock, the green-uniformed Octoroon stepped out of his helicopter. Bernard was waiting for him among the agaves. "Miss Crown's gone on summer holiday," he explained. "Can hardly be back before 5, which leaves us 7 hours. He could fly to Santa Fe, do all the business he had to do, and be in Malpais again long before she woke up. "She'll be quite safe here by herself?"
"Safe as helicopters,"
the Octoroon assured him. They climbed into the machine and started off at once. At 10:34 they landed on the roof of the Santa Fe post office. At 10:37, Bernard had got through to the World Controller's office in Whitehall. At 10:39, he was speaking to his Fordship's 4th personal secretary. At 10:44, he was repeating his story to the first secretary, and at 10:47 and a half, it was the deep, resonant voice of Mustafa Mond himself that sounded in his ears.
"I venture to think," stammered Bernard, "that your Fordship might find the matter of sufficient scientific interest."
"Yes, I do find it of sufficient scientific interest," said the deep voice. "Bring these 2 individuals back to London with you."
"Your Fordship is aware that I shall need a special permit."
"The necessary orders," said Mustafa Mond, "are being sent to the warden of the reservation at this moment. You will proceed at once to the warden's office. Good morning, Mr. Marks."
There was silence. Bernard hung up the receiver and hurried up to the roof.
"Warden's office," he said to the gamma-green Octoroon.
At 10:54, Bernard was shaking hands with the warden.
"Delighted, Mr. Marks, delighted!"
His boom was deferential.
"We have just received special orders."
"I know," said Bernard, interrupting him. "I was talking to his Fordship on the phone a moment ago."
His bored tone implied that he was in the habit of talking to his Fordship every day of the week. He dropped into a chair. "If you'll kindly take all the necessary steps as soon as possible." "As soon as possible," he emphatically repeated. He was thoroughly enjoying himself. At 11:03, he had all the necessary papers in his pocket.
"So long,"
he said patronizingly to the warden, who had accompanied him as far as the lift gates.
"So long!"
He walked across the hotel, had a bath, a vibrovac massage, and an electrolytic shave, listened in to the morning's news, looked in for 30 minutes on the televisor, ate a leisured luncheon, and at 2:30 flew back with the Octoroon to Malpais. The young man stood outside the rest house.
"Bernard!"
he called.
"Bernard!"
There was no answer. Noiseless, on his deerskin moccasins, he ran up the steps and tried the door. The door was locked. They were gone. Gone! It was the most terrible thing that had ever happened to him. She had asked him to come and see them, and now they were gone. He sat down on the steps and cried. Half an hour later, it occurred to him to look through the window. The first thing he saw was a green suitcase with the initials LC painted on the lid. Joy flared up like fire within him. He picked up a stone. The smashed glass tinkled on the floor. A moment later, he was inside the room. He opened the green suitcase, and all at once he was breathing Lenina's perfume, filling his lungs with her essential being. His heart beat wildly. For a moment he was almost faint. Then, bending over the precious box, he touched, he lifted into the light, he examined. The zippers on Lenina's spare pair of viscous velveteen shorts were at first a puzzle, then solved, a delight. Zip, and then zip, zip, and then zip. He was enchanted. Her green slippers were the most beautiful things he had ever seen. He unfolded a pair of zippy kamenics, blushed, put them hastily away again, but kissed a perfumed acetate handkerchief and wound a scarf round his neck. Opening a box, he spilt a cloud of scented powder. His hands were floury with the stuff. He wiped them on his chest, on his shoulders, on his bare arms. Delicious perfume! He shut his eyes. He rubbed his cheek against his own powdered arm. Touch of smooth skin against his face. Scent in his nostrils of musky dusk. Her real presence. "Lenina," he whispered. "Lenina." A noise made him start, made him guiltily turn. He crammed up his thieveries into the suitcase and shut the lid. Then listened again, looked. Not a sign of life, not a sound. And yet he had certainly heard something, something like a sigh, something like the creak of a board. He tiptoed to the door and, cautiously opening it, found himself looking onto a broad landing. On the opposite side of the landing was another door, ajar. He stepped out, pushed, peeped. There, on a low bed, the sheet flung back, dressed in a pair of pink one-piece zippy jammers, lay Lenina, fast asleep, and so beautiful in the midst of her curls, so touchingly childish with her pink toes and her grave, sleeping face, so trustful in the helplessness of her limp hands and melted limbs, that the tears came to his eyes. With an infinity of quite unnecessary precautions, for nothing short of a pistol shot could have called Lenina back from her summer holiday before the appointed time, he entered the room. He knelt on the floor beside the bed. He gazed. He clasped his hands. His lips moved.
"Her eyes," he murmured. "Her eyes, her hair, her cheek, her gait, her voice. Handliest in thy discourse. Oh, that her hand, in whose comparison all whites are ink, writing their own reproach, to whose soft seizure the signet's down is harsh."
A fly buzzed round her. He waved it away.
"Flies," he remembered, "on the white wonder of dear Juliet's hand, may seize and steal immortal blessings from her lips, who even in pure and vestal modesty still blush, as thinking their own kisses sin."
Very slowly, with the hesitating gesture of one who reaches forward to stroke a shy and possibly rather dangerous bird, he put out his hand. It hung there, trembling, within an inch of those limp fingers, on the verge of contact. Did he dare? Dare to profane with his unworthiest hand that? No, he didn't. The bird was too dangerous. His hand dropped back. How beautiful she was! How beautiful! Then, suddenly, he found himself reflecting that he had only to take hold of the zipper at her neck and give one long, strong pull. He shut his eyes. He shook his head with the gesture of a dog shaking its ears as it emerges from the water. Detestable thought! He was ashamed of himself. Pure and vestal modesty! There was a humming in the air. Another fly trying to steal immortal blessings? A wasp? He looked, saw nothing. The humming grew louder and louder, localized itself as being outside the shuttered windows. The plane! In a panic, he scrambled to his feet and ran into the other room, vaulted through the open window, and hurrying along the path between the tall agaves, was in time to receive Bernard Marx as he climbed out of the helicopter. Chapter 10. The hands of all the 4,000 electric clocks in all the Bloomsbury Centre's 4,000 rooms marked 2:27 past 2. This hive of industry, as the director was fond of calling it, was in the full buzz of work. Everyone was busy, everything in ordered motion. Under the microscopes, their long tails furiously lashing, the spermatozoa were burrowing headfirst into eggs, and, fertilized, the eggs were expanding, dividing, or if Bokanovskified, budding and breaking up into whole populations of separate embryos. From the social predestination room, the escalators went rumbling down into the basement, and there, in the crimson darkness, stewingly warm on their cushion of peritoneum, and gorged with blood surrogate and hormones, the fetuses grew and grew, or, poisoned, languished into a stunted epsilon hood. With a faint hum and rattle, the moving racks crawled imperceptibly through the weeks and the recapitulated eons to where, in the decanting room, the newly unbottled babes uttered their first yell of horror and amazement. The dynamos purred in the sub-basement. The lifts rushed up and down. On all the 11 floors of nurseries, it was feeding time. From 1,800 bottles, 1,800 carefully labelled infants were simultaneously sucking down their pint of pasteurized external secretion. Above them, in 10 successive layers of dormitory, the little boys and girls who were still young enough to need an afternoon sleep were as busy as everyone else, though they did not know it, listening unconsciously to hypnopedic lessons in hygiene and sociability, in class consciousness and toddler's love life. Above these again were the playrooms where, the weather having turned to rain, 900 older children were amusing themselves with brick and clay modelling, hunt the zipper, and erotic play. Buzz, buzz, the hive was humming busily, joyfully. Blithe was the singing of the young girls over their test tubes. The predestinators whistled as they worked, and in the decanting room what glorious jokes were cracked above the empty bottles. But the director's face, as he entered the fertilizing room with Henry Foster, was grave, wooden with severity. "A public example," he was saying. "In this room, because it contains more high-caste workers than any other in the centre, I have told him to meet me here at 2:30. "He does his work very well," put in Henry with hypocritical generosity. "I know. But that's all the more reason for severity. His intellectual eminence carries with it corresponding moral responsibilities. The greater a man's talents, the greater his power to lead astray. It is better that one should suffer than that many should be corrupted. Consider the matter dispassionately, Mr. Foster, and you will see that no offence is so heinous as unorthodoxy of behaviour. Murder kills only the individual, and after all, what is an individual?" With a sweeping gesture, he indicated the rows of microscopes, the test tubes, the incubators. "We can make a new one with the greatest ease, as many as we like. Unorthodoxy threatens more than the life of a mere individual. It strikes at society itself. Yes, at society itself," he repeated. "Ah, but here he comes." Bernard had entered the room and was advancing between the rows of fertilizers towards them. A veneer of jaunty self-confidence thinly concealed his nervousness. The voice in which he said, "Good morning, Director," was absurdly too loud. That in which, correcting his mistake, he said, "You asked me to come and speak to you here." Ridiculously soft, a squeak. "Yes, Mr. Marx," said the Director portentously, "I did ask you to come to me here. You returned from your holiday last night, I understand.
Yes, Bernard answered.
Yes, repeated the director, lingering a serpent on the S. Then suddenly raising his voice, "Ladies and gentlemen," he trumpeted, "ladies and gentlemen."
The singing of the girls over their test tubes, the preoccupied whistling of the microscopists, suddenly ceased. There was a profound silence. Everyone looked round.
"Ladies and gentlemen," the director repeated once more, "excuse me for thus interrupting your labours. A painful duty constrains me. The security and stability of society are in danger. Yes, in danger, ladies and gentlemen. This man," he pointed accusingly at Bernard, "this man who stands before you here, this Alpha Plus to whom so much has been given, and from whom, in consequence, so much must be expected, this colleague of yours, or should I anticipate and say this ex-colleague, has grossly betrayed the trust imposed in him by his heretical views on sport and soma, by the scandalous unorthodoxy of his sex life, by his refusal to obey the teachings of our Ford and behave out of office hours even as a little infant." Here the director made the sign of the T. "He has proved himself an enemy of society, a subverter, ladies and gentlemen, of all order and stability, a conspirator against civilization itself. For this reason I propose to dismiss him, with ignominy from the post he has held in this center. I propose forthwith to apply for his transference to a sub-center of the lowest order, and, that his punishment may serve the best interests of society, as far as possible removed from any important center of population. In Iceland, he will have small opportunity to lead others astray by his unfordly example."
The director paused. Then, folding his arms, he turned impressively to Bernard.
"Marx," he said, "can you show any reason why I should not now execute the judgment passed upon you?"
"Yes, I can,"
Bernard answered in a very loud voice, somewhat taken aback, but still majestically.
"Then show it," said the director.
"Certainly, but it's in the passage. One moment."
Bernard hurried to the door and threw it open.
"Come in,"
he commanded. And the reason came in and showed itself. There was a gasp, a murmur of astonishment and horror. A young girl screamed. Standing on a chair to get a better view, someone upset two test tubes full of spermatozoa. Bloated, sagging, and among those firm youthful bodies, those undistorted faces, a strange and terrifying monster of middle-agedness, Linda advanced into the room, coquettishly smiling her broken and discolored smile, and rolling, as she walked, with what was meant to be a voluptuous undulation, her enormous haunches. Bernard walked beside her.
"There he is," he said, pointing at the director. "Do you think I didn't recognize him?"
Linda asked indignantly. Then, turning to the director,
"Of course I knew you, Tomakin. I should have known you anywhere among a thousand. But perhaps you've forgotten me. Don't you remember? Don't you remember, Tomakin? You're Linda?"
She stood looking at him, her head on one side, still smiling, but with a smile that became progressively, in face of the director's expression of petrified disgust, less and less self-confident, that wavered and finally went out.
"Don't you remember, Tomakin?"
she repeated in a voice that trembled. Her eyes were anxious, agonized. The blotched and sagging face twitched grotesquely into the grimace of extreme grief.
"Tomakin!"
She held out her arms. Someone began to titter.
"What's the meaning," began the director, "of this monstrous—"
"Tomakin!"
She ran forward, her blanket trailing behind her, threw her arms round his neck, hid her face on his chest. A howl of laughter went up irrepressibly.
"This monstrous practical joke!"
the director shouted. Red in the face, he tried to disengage himself from her embrace. Desperately she clung.
"But I'm Linda! I'm Linda!"
The laughter drowned her voice.
"You made me have a baby!"
she screamed above the uproar. There was a sudden and appalling hush. Eyes floated uncomfortably, not knowing where to look. The director went suddenly pale, stopped struggling and stood, his hands on her wrists, staring down at her, horrified.
"Yes, a baby! And I was its mother!"
She flung the obscenity like a challenge into the outraged silence. Then, suddenly breaking away from him, ashamed, ashamed, covered her face with her hands, sobbing.
"It wasn't my fault, Tamakin, because I always did my drill, didn't I? Didn't I? Always. I don't know how. If you knew how awful, Tamakin. But he was a comfort to me all the same."
Turning towards the door.
"John!"
she called.
"John!"
He came in at once, paused for a moment just inside the door, looked round, then soft on his moccasined feet, strode quickly across the room, fell on his knees in front of the director, and said in a clear voice,
"My father!"
The word for father was not so much obscene as, with its connotation of something at one remove from the loathsomeness and moral obliquity of childbearing, merely gross, a scatological, rather than a pornographic impropriety. The comically smutty word relieved what had become a quite intolerable tension. Laughter broke out, enormous, almost hysterical, peal after peal, as though it would never stop.
"My father! And it was the director! My father! Oh, Ford! Oh, Ford! That was really too good!"
The whooping and the roaring renewed themselves. Faces seemed on the point of disintegration. Tears were streaming. 6 more test tubes of spermatozoa were upset. "My father!" Pale, wild-eyed, the director glared about him in an agony of bewildered humiliation.
"My father!"
The laughter, which had shown signs of dying away, broke out again more loudly than ever. He put his hands over his ears and rushed out of the room. Chapter 11. After the scene in the fertilizing room, all upper-caste London was wild to see this delicious creature who had fallen on his knees before the director of hatcheries and conditioning, or rather the ex-director, for the poor man had resigned immediately afterwards and never set foot inside the centre again, had flopped down and called him, the joke was almost too good to be true, "my father." Linda, on the contrary, cut no ice. Nobody had the smallest desire to see Linda. To say one was a mother, that was past a joke. It was an obscenity. Moreover, she wasn't a real savage. She had been hatched out of a bottle and conditioned like anyone else, so couldn't have really quaint ideas. Finally, and this was by far the strongest reason for people's not wanting to see poor Linda, there was her appearance. Fat, having lost her youth, with bad teeth and a blotched complexion, and that figure, Ford. You simply couldn't look at her without feeling sick. Yes, positively sick. So the best people were quite determined not to see Linda. And Linda, for her part, had no desire to see them. The return to civilization was for her the return to Soma, was the possibility of lying in bed and taking holiday after holiday, without ever having to come back to a headache or a fit of vomiting, without ever being made to feel as you always felt after peyotl, as though you'd done something so shamefully antisocial that you could never hold up your head again. Soma played none of these unpleasant tricks. The holiday it gave was perfect, and if the morning after was disagreeable, it was so not intrinsically, but only by comparison with the joys of the holiday. The remedy was to make the holiday continuous. Greedily she clamoured for ever larger, ever more frequent doses. Dr. Shaw at first demurred, then let her have what she wanted. She took as much as 20 grams a day. "Which will finish her off in a month or two," the doctor confided to Bernard. "One day the respiratory center will be paralyzed. No more breathing, finished. And a good thing, too. If we could rejuvenate, of course, it would be different. But we can't." Surprisingly, as everyone thought, for on summer holiday Linda was most conveniently out of the way, John raised objections.
"But aren't you shortening her life by giving her so much?"
"In one sense, yes," Dr. Shaw admitted. "But in another, we're actually lengthening it."
The young man stared, uncomprehending.
"Soma may make you lose a few years in time," the doctor went on. "But think of the enormous, immeasurable durations it can give you out of time. Every summer holiday is a bit of what our ancestors used to call eternity."
John began to understand.
"Eternity was in our lips and eyes," he murmured.
"Eh?"
"Nothing."
"Of course," Dr. Shaw went on. "You can't allow people to go popping off into eternity if they've got any serious work to do. But as she hasn't got any serious work..."
"All the same," John persisted, "I don't believe it's right."
The doctor shrugged his shoulders.
"Well, of course, if you prefer to have her screaming mad all the time."
In the end, John was forced to give in. Linda got her soma. Thenceforward, she remained in her little room on the 37th floor of Bernard's apartment house, in bed, with the radio and television always on, and the patchouli tap just dripping, and the soma tablets within reach of her hand. There she remained, and yet wasn't there at all, was all the time away, infinitely far away, on holiday in some other world, where the music of the radio was a labyrinth of sonorous colours, a sliding, palpitating labyrinth that led, by what beautifully inevitable windings, to a bright centre of absolute conviction, where the dancing images of the television box were the performers in some indescribably delicious, all-singing feely, where the dripping patchouli was more than scent, was the sun, was a million saxophones, was Popeye making love, only much more so, incomparably more, and without end.
"No, we can't rejuvenate, but I'm very glad," Dr. Shaw had concluded, "to have had this opportunity to see an example of senility in a human being. Thank you so much for calling me in."
He shook Bernard warmly by the hand. It was John, then, that they were after. And as it was only through Bernard, his accredited guardian, that John could be seen, Bernard now found himself for the first time in his life treated not merely normally, but as a person of outstanding importance. There was no more talk of the alcohol in his blood surrogate, no jibes at his personal appearance. Henry Foster went out of his way to be friendly. Benita Hoover made him a present of 6 packets of sex hormone chewing gum. The assistant predestinator came and cadged almost abjectly for an invitation to one of Bernard's evening parties. As for the women, Bernard had only to hint at the possibility of an invitation, and he could have whichever of them he liked.
"Bernard's asked me to meet the Savage next Wednesday," Fanny announced triumphantly.
"I'm so glad," said Lenina. "And now you must admit that you were wrong about Bernard. Don't you think he's really rather sweet?" Fanny nodded.
"And I must say," she said, "I was quite agreeably surprised."
"The chief butler?
the Director of Predestination, 3 Deputy Assistant Fertilizer Generals, the Professor of Feelies in the College of Emotional Engineering, the Dean of the Westminster Community Singery, the Supervisor of Buccanuffskification. The list of Bernard's notabilities was interminable. "And I had 6 girls last week," he confided to Helmholtz Watson. "One on Monday, 2 on Tuesday, 2 more on Friday, and 1 on Saturday. And if I'd had the time or the inclination, there were at least 12 more who were only too anxious."
Helmholtz listened to his boastings in a silence so gloomily disapproving that Bernard was offended.
"You're envious," he said.
Helmholtz shook his head. "I'm rather sad, that's all," he answered. Bernard went off in a huff. Never, he told himself, never would he speak to Helmholtz again. The days passed. Success went fizzily to Bernard's head, and in the process completely reconciled him, as any good intoxicant should do, to a world which, up till then, he had found very unsatisfactory. Insofar as it recognized him as important, the order of things was good. But, reconciled by his success, he yet refused to forego the privilege of criticizing this order. For the act of criticizing heightened his sense of importance, made him feel larger. Moreover, he did genuinely believe that there were things to criticize. At the same time, he genuinely liked being a success and having all the girls he wanted. Before those who now, for the sake of the savage, paid their court to him, Bernard would parade a carping unorthodoxy. He was politely listened to, but behind his back people shook their heads. "That young man will come to a bad end," they said, prophesying the more confidently in that they themselves would in due course personally see to it that the end was bad. "He won't find another savage to help him out a second time," they said. Meanwhile, however, there was the first savage. They were polite, and because they were polite, Bernard felt positively gigantic. Gigantic, and at the same time light with elation, lighter than air.
"Lighter than air," said Bernard, pointing upwards.
Like a pearl in the sky, high, high above them, the weather department's captive balloon shone rosily in the sunshine.
"The said savage," so ran Bernard's instructions, "to be shown civilized life in all its aspects."
He was being shown a bird's-eye view of it at present, a bird's-eye view from the platform of the Charing Tea Tower. The stationmaster and the resident meteorologist were acting as guides. But it was Bernard who did most of the talking. Intoxicated, he was behaving as though, at the very least, he were a visiting world controller, lighter than air. The Bombay green rocket dropped out of the sky. The passengers alighted. 8 identical Dravidian twins in khaki looked out of the 8 portholes of the cabin, the stewards.
1,250 kilometers an hour, said the station master impressively. What do you think of that, Mr. Savage?
John thought it was very nice.
Still, he said, Ariel could put a girdle round the earth in 40 minutes.
The Savage, wrote Bernard in his report to Mustafa Mond,
shows surprisingly little astonishment at or awe of civilized inventions. This is partly due, no doubt, to the fact that he has heard them talked about by the woman Linda, his M-dash.
Mustafa Mond frowned.
Does the fool think I am too squeamish to see the word written out at full length?
Partly on his interest being focused on what he calls the soul, which he persists in regarding as an entity independent of the physical environment, whereas, as I tried to point out to him...
The controller skipped the next sentences and was just about to turn the page in search of something more interestingly concrete when his eye was caught by a series of quite extraordinary phrases.
"Though I must admit," he read,
that I agree with the savage in finding civilized infantility too easy or, as he puts it, not expensive enough. And I would like to take this opportunity of drawing your fortship's attention to...
Mustafa Mon's anger gave place almost at once to mirth. The idea of this creature solemnly lecturing him, about the social order was really too grotesque. The man must have gone mad. "I ought to give him a lesson," he said to himself, then threw back his head and laughed aloud. For the moment, at any rate, the lesson would not be given. It was a small factory of lighting sets for helicopters, a branch of the Electrical Equipment Corporation. They were met on the roof itself, for that circular letter of recommendation from the controller was magical in its effects, by the chief technician and the human element manager. They walked downstairs into the factory.
"Each process," explained the human element manager, "is carried out as far as possible by a single Bokanovsky group."
And, in effect, 83 almost noseless black brachycephalic deltas were cold-pressing. The 56 four-spindle chucking and turning machines were being manipulated by 56 aquiline and ginger gammas. 107 heat-conditioned Epsilon Senegalese were working in the foundry. 33 Delta females, long-headed, sandy, with narrow pelvises, and all within 20 millimeters of 1 meter 69 centimeters tall, were cutting screws. In the assembling room, the dynamos were being put together by two sets of gamma-plus dwarfs. The two low-work tables faced one another. Between them crawled the conveyor with its load of separate parts. 47 blonde heads were confronted by 47 brown ones, 47 snubs by 47 hooks, 47 receding by 47 prognathous chins. The completed mechanisms were inspected by 18 identical curly auburn girls in gamma green, packed in crates by 34 short-legged left-handed male Delta Minuses, and loaded into the waiting trucks and lorries by 63 blue-eyed, flaxen, and freckled Epsilon semimorons.
Oh, brave new world!
By some malice of his memory, the savage found himself repeating Miranda's words.
Oh, brave new world that has such people in it!
"And I assure you,"
the human element manager concluded as they left the factory,
"we hardly ever have any trouble with our workers. We always find..."
But the savage had suddenly broken away from his companions, and was violently retching behind a clump of laurels, as though the solid earth had been a helicopter in an air pocket.
"The savage," wrote Bernard, "refuses to take Soma, and seems much distressed because the woman Linda, his M-dash, remains permanently on holiday. It is worthy of note that, in spite of his M-dash's senility, and the extreme repulsiveness of her appearance, the savage frequently goes to see her, and appears to be much attached to her. An interesting example of the way in which early conditioning can be made to modify and even run counter to natural impulses. In this case, the impulse to recoil from an unpleasant object."
At Eton, they alighted on the roof of the upper school. On the opposite side of the schoolyard, the 52 stories of Lupton's Tower gleamed white in the sunshine. College on their left, and on their right, the school community singery reared their venerable piles of ferro-concrete and vitaglass. In the centre of the quadrangle stood the quaint old chrome-steel statue of R. Ford. Dr. Gaffney, the provost, and Miss Keat, the headmistress, received them as they stepped out of the plane.
"Do you have many twins here?" the savage asked, rather apprehensively, as they set out on their tour of inspection.
"Oh, no," the provost answered. "Eton is reserved exclusively for upper-caste boys and girls. One egg, one adult.
It makes education more difficult, of course. But as they'll be called upon to take responsibilities and deal with unexpected emergencies, it can't be helped.
He sighed. Bernard, meanwhile, had taken a strong fancy to Miss Keat.
"If you're free any Monday, Wednesday, or Friday evening," he was saying, jerking his thumb towards the savage. "He's curious, you know," Bernard added.
"Quaint."
Miss Keat smiled, and her smile was really charming, he thought, said thank you, would be delighted to come to one of his parties. The provost opened a door. 5 minutes in that Alpha Double Plus classroom left John a trifle bewildered.
"What is elementary relativity?"
he whispered to Bernard. Bernard tried to explain, then thought better of it, and suggested that they should go to some other classroom. From behind a door in the corridor leading to the Beta Minus geography room, a ringing soprano voice called,
"One, two, three, four,"
and then with a weary impatience,
"As you were."
"Malthusian drill," explained the headmistress.
"Most of our girls are free martins, of course. I'm a free martin myself."
She smiled at Bernard.
"But we have about 800 unsterilized ones who need constant drilling."
In the Beta Minus geography room, John learnt that a savage reservation is a place which, owing to unfavorable climatic or geological conditions, or poverty of natural resources, had not been worth the expense of civilizing. A click, the room was darkened, and suddenly, on the screen above the master's head, there were the penitentes of Acoma prostrating themselves before Our Lady, and wailing, as John had heard them wail, confessing their sins before Jesus on the cross, before the eagle image of Pukong. The young Etonians fairly shouted with laughter. Still wailing, the penitentes rose to their feet, stripped off their upper garments, and with knotted whips began to beat themselves blow after blow. Redoubled, the laughter drowned even the amplified record of their groans.
"But why do they laugh?"
asked the savage in a pained bewilderment.
"Why?"
The provost turned towards him a still broadly grinning face.
"Why? Because it's so extraordinarily funny!"
In the cinematographic twilight, Bernard risked a gesture which, in the past, even total darkness would hardly have emboldened him to make. Strong in his new importance, he put his arm round the headmistress's waist. It yielded willowily. He was just about to snatch a kiss or two, and perhaps a gentle pinch, when the shutters clicked open again.
"Perhaps we had better go on," said Miss Keat, and moved towards the door.
"And this," said the provost a moment later, "is the hypnopedic control room."
Hundreds of synthetic music boxes, one for each dormitory, stood ranged in shelves round three sides of the room. Pigeonholed on the fourth were the paper soundtrack rolls on which the various hypnopedic lessons were printed.
"You slip the roll in here," explained Bernard, interrupting Dr. Gaffney. "Press down this switch."
"No, that one," corrected the provost, annoyed.
"That one, then. The roll unwinds, the selenium cells transform the light impulses into sound waves, and..."
"And there you are,"
Dr. Gaffney concluded.
"Do they read Shakespeare?"
asked the savage, as they walked on their way to the biochemical laboratories past the school library.
"Certainly not,"
said the headmistress, blushing.
"Our library," said Dr. Gaffney, "contains only books of reference. If our young people need distraction, they can get it at the Feelers. We don't encourage them to indulge in any solitary amusements."
5 busloads of boys and girls, singing or in a silent embracement, rolled past them over the vitrified highway.
"Just returned,"
explained Dr. Gaffney, while Bernard, whispering, made an appointment with the headmistress for that very evening.
"From the Slough Crematorium. Death conditioning begins at 18 months. Every tot spends 2 mornings a week in a hospital for the dying. All the best toys are kept there, and they get chocolate cream on death days.
They learn to take dying as a matter of course.
Like any other physiological process,
put in the headmistress professionally. 8 o'clock at the Savoy. It was all arranged. On their way back to London, they stopped at the Television Corporation's factory at